Imagine spending your day walking among the flowers or living in a hexagonal-shaped home, creating golden coins and ambrosia of pollen and honey. Sweet honey. It would seem to be a being of high consciousness, but coming up against one of these beings, it seems we worry only about being stung. Today's guest, Simon Buxton, is a beekeeper and director of The Sacred Trust, a United Kingdom-based educational organization dedicated to the practice of shamanism. Simon's book, The Shamanic Way of the Bee, Ancient Wisdom and Healing Practices of the Bee Masters, details his experiences of initiation into and life on the path of pollen. Stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare, and this is Tributaries. Simon, thank you for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Robin.
So, am I the only one who's never heard of the path of pollen? I mean, without meaning any disrespect, it sounds somewhat like the things I dreamed up for my show when it fell on April Fool's Day.
Well, yes. It's true that it is undoubtedly the most enigmatic and, let's say, even private lineage of shamanism in the world. The reality is that the way of the bee is actually near universal. In other words, pretty much wherever the bee, the honeybee, can be found, you'll find there are practitioners of this way of working. I mean, not merely as a kind of metaphor, but also as a repository for an astonishingly rich shamanic knowledge. But the bottom line is that it hasn't been until very recently that any people who work within this lineage have felt a need or a desire to put pen to paper. Historically, the beauty about the way of the bee is that it has been truly invisible. And as a result of its invisibility in the world, that is the very thing that has allowed it to survive. If we reflect on the history of the persecution of shamanic culture and pagan culture right across the world, primarily through missionization and the introduction of modern technologies into the remaining proto-historical cultures, what we see is that it was those very things that actually diminished and fragmented shamanic traditions. But the way of the bee was truly invisible. These were simply beekeepers. And beekeepers have always been popular figures within communities because they've been suppliers of sweet elixirs. So it was a beautiful way for them to remain invisible or near invisible at times when other shamanic cultures and pagan cultures were being persecuted and attacked. And particularly in Europe, nearly all the shamanic traditions were destroyed, with one or two exceptions. So it's true, it is obscure, but the other truth is that it is, in fact, near universal, and near universal, but beautifully hidden, and that has allowed it to survive up until the present day.
Well, that brings a couple of questions to mind. One thing that is becoming more and more obvious is that these shamanic traditions are finding it's time to make themselves known on the planet because of everything that's going on. And there are groups of elders from many traditions that are holding councils together.
Correct.
Now and making a point to really come together.
Yeah.
I found it very curious that with your involvement in the Path of Pollen, that you also became involved with Michael Harner's shamanism. And it seems, through my experience, Michael did bring shamanism to the masses, so to speak. He held numerous classes and that sort of thing. And especially reading how your path is continued with one master, one teacher. That was part of my problem with what Michael Harner was doing with shamanism.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And, you know, Michael Harner has been one of my teachers as well. And in the end, he turned around and requested that I teach for the foundation in Britain. I have to say it came as a complete surprise, and I was somewhat of a kind of reluctant teacher initially. But Michael's gift, I think, to the world is that he recognized the universality of shamanic practices. I mean, after all, if we the very word shamanic was originally a specific term relating to a particular people in Siberia and China, but when anthropologists began to see that the practices they saw practiced in that part of the world were also being practiced elsewhere, they borrowed the term shaman, and it became an academic term, if you like, an anthropological term. And what Michael has done is recognize that shamanism, in fact, is a group of methods and practices, and it doesn't need to be culture-centric. Now, that's very important because most people in the world today are not, let's say, indigenous peoples. So by teaching the core methods that you find whenever you choose to inspect an indigenous culture and strip away the cultural glosses, what you find is this core body of methods. And by being able to teach this core body of methods, it means that we don't have to appropriate somebody else's culture. And so I think it's a very liberating thing that he has done. And in terms of the relationship between my relationship with Michael Harner and the Way of the Bee, when I first met Michael, I was delighted to see that the active principles that he was teaching are the very ones that are indeed found within the path of pollen. And we can boil that right down to first principles, which is that the shaman is somebody who moves from this reality into a parallel universe. And I mean, that would be a kind of accepted modern definition of what a shaman does. They move from this reality into a separate reality where they access information, they access wisdom, and they then return back to their community. And that, of course, is the principle that also drives the Way of the Bee, learning how to move into a separate consciousness. Let's call it a mythical landscape, by stimulating the mythical imagination. I mean, after all, the other choice is that we stay in the place of rationality. And, you know, if we look at our modern world, we swim like fish in a sea of rationality. And so what we actually really need to do is we need to move from the rational mind into the mythical mind. And by awakening the mythical mind, which is what Bridge, my own teacher in the path of pollen, did, that allows us to explore the mythical landscapes. And it's in those mythical landscapes where we do our work and receive our healing and also meet our destiny.
Well, I've always felt that rationalization was man's greatest tool, but now I see it almost as you know, some of our other great tools that can either be used for good or for devastation.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's like a hammer, isn't it? Yes. You can use it to build a house or to bang somebody on the head. I mean, these things are neutral, absolutely.
Now, I want to move out of the interview. I'm editing this out for a second. Do you have, like, 20 more minutes to go?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because just the way the first question went, I'd love to get two shows, because this is you're so fascinating.
Fine, let's just go for it.
Okay, sounds great.
And we'll just stop when we stop.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you so much. Now, within this ancient tradition of the Bee Masters, I've heard it said that you work outside and beyond the laws of science. And, of course, this relates to the shaman moving into a parallel universe. But maybe you could talk about this a little bit more and how it relates directly to this tradition.
Yeah, I mean, when terms such as outside the laws of science, I need to make it clear what we're talking about is all outside the known laws.
Newtonian, not not quantum.
Exactly. So what we're actually seeing is that slowly the scientific community are slowly catching up with what I call the first scientists. The first scientists are our ancestors. It's as simple as that. They were the one who determined how to, for example, work with plants in a medicinal fashion. They were the ones who arrived at the extraordinary body of information from within the way of the bee. In other words, how to use a bee sting as a means of bringing about health and healing and also transcendental states. They were the ones who worked out how to play a percussional instrument at a particular tempo that would move your state of consciousness. So the shamans were the first scientists. Now, sadly, we live in a world where much of science is kind of truncated, primarily because in the age of enlightenment, as it were, so-called, science separated away from in Europe, at least, from the church, because they were scared of being persecuted by the church as being, potentially as being witches. And in those days, witches were persecuted and killed and so on. So the scientific community pretty much turned around to the church and said, hey, we're just not interested in anything other than the material thing. We're not witches, don't burn us. And at that point, science kind of betrayed us, because at that point, they made a declaration that spirits and spirit did not exist. Now, the truth is that science has a responsibility for disproving theories. It's actually called falsification. And the one area that was so vital to, as it were, disprove was the existence of spirit or spirits. But they chose not to. They chose not to for historically understandable reasons, because they were very nervous of being persecuted. But that left us with a truncated science. So where that left the shamans was that, well, they had already done the science every day, or more often every night, for thousands and thousands of years, at least 40,000 years. They have been communing with spirit and spirits. And when I say communing, I'm talking about encountering this parallel world in a real empirical way. I mean, the common terms are ordinary and non-ordinary reality. So you have ordinary reality, which is this reality, and then you have non-ordinary reality. But if you'll note, both terms use the word reality, which means they can be empirically encountered. So from a shamanic point of view, this other world, this parallel universe, is as real, and for some shamanic cultures, more real than this world. In the tradition that I trained within, the world is seen as being both as equally real. And part of the training is to keep on moving from this world into the other world. And slowly, the reality of the other world becomes as real and as important, and the relationships therein as vital as those that one holds within this world.
Certainly, the veil does become and can become very thin. And I would like to ask you, Simon, to talk about the bee stings, because we're talking about moving back and forth, and there's a very little known tradition you're about to share with us about bee stings. We've spoken actually on Tributaries years ago about using bee sting therapy for arthritis and arthritis cures. And it's recently come to my attention that there is also something widespread about beekeepers not ever getting cancer.
Yes, that's a most interesting fact. And
what
frankly,
is that about? Yes.
If there was anything that pushed people towards the possibility of becoming beekeepers, I would say look at the statistics. If anybody could be motivated to go and contact local cancer hospitals and hospices and so on, where they carry statistics, and you look at the list of areas of employment. In other words, which are the professions that have the most common incidences of cancer, and which are those professions that have the least common instances of cancer? And guess what? In every body of statistic that I've looked at, the profession with the least instance of cancer are the beekeepers. And the reasons are very straightforward. It's what the beekeeper encounters in their craft. And here we're talking about the gifts of the hive. And the gifts of the hive, the four most well-known gifts are, of course, honey, which we all know about, and pollen, which we all know about, even if we just know about it from biology class. Royal jelly, which most of your listeners will have heard about or maybe even take as a nutritional supplement. And also, last but by no means least, that is the venom of the bee sting. And the most recent research would indicate that it's the impact of having the venom going into the system, the human system, that may be the primary reason why beekeepers do not seem to get cancer, or very, very, very rarely. Now, it's interesting because within the tradition that I trained, which formally, by the way, is called the Path of Pollen, the formal initiation into the tradition, because it is an initiatory tradition, it's actually done by the use of bee venom. So the bee venom from the bee sting is considered actually to be one of the great secrets of the tradition. It's actually called sacred fire, and bee shamans over hundreds, thousands of years have mapped out ways of working with the bee sting, much in the way that the needles are used by the modern acupuncturist. And in fact, curiously and fascinating, if you travel to China, you'll find that still to this day, you will find some of the older acupuncturists still, to this day, dip their needles into bee venom before inserting them into their clients' bodies. So here there's some curious resonance, some echo of the past when the bee was used as the needle. So within the Path of Pollen, it is clearly stated, let's say suggested, because this would be very difficult to prove in terms of documentation, that the original acupuncturists in the world were actually the bee shamans, and they used the bee sting of the bee in exactly the way that the needle is used by the modern acupuncturist.
So the meridians do overlap as far as the system goes?
Well, the meridian systems overlap. There are some differences, but I think, in fact, the most important difference, really, between the, let's call it the Chinese system of acupuncture, and the system that has evolved through the Path of Pollen, is that unlike acupuncture, where one is largely working with predefined meridians, the process is slightly different within the bee tradition because one is operating in concert with the bee. In other words, one is within an altered state of consciousness, and the spirit of the hive itself is directing the placement of the bee stings. So yes, there are the meridian systems, but beyond that, it is directed by the wisdom of the hive. Now, the second thing that really needs to be stated, because this also distinguishes it from the Chinese system, is that the sting is not only used as a therapeutic tool. In other words, it's not just used for people who are unwell. It's also used as a tool for creating altered states. So much of my training involved learning how to use bee stings not only for therapeutic use and healing, because, of course, healing is the cornerstone, the central to the role of the shaman the world over, but also to produce particular altered state experiences. And the primary initiation into the tradition actually involves being stung on the body, which actually creates a certain threshold experience. Now, so what happens is one is stung on points of the body. The master shaman, in communion with the hive, induces an experience in the apprentice, in the person stepping onto the path, which brings about a move, and it's a move from this world into the world of the hive. Essentially, what happens is that one is reborn into the hive, and that rebirth initiates a symbiotic relationship with the hive itself, and if successful, is never broken. So in other words, a marriage is made between the human being and the being who is considered to be our most ancient ally. In other words, the honeybee.
That's very true, isn't it? Along with all of the ancient drawings and depictions of animals, there is certainly the serpent that most people are aware of, but the bee has been in there also.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? There are a couple of things there. I mean, first of all, that bee shamans know that the honeybee is humanity's most ancient ally. And it's kind of a bold assertion, but it's actually rarely disputed, because the bottom line is they've been on our Earth since the, some 55 million years. I mean, that goes back to the Cenozoic period, I think it is, which is around 55 million years. Now, if you want to jump a whole lot forward into, let's say, a period of old Europe, in other words, that's about 7,000 to 3,500 BC, what we find within archaeological digs is that next to serpents, the bees are the creatures that are most often depicted, which is fascinating. And, of course, there are certain things that both the bee and the serpent have in common. Both of them live in small, dark places, and both, of course, carry venom, and both come out of a little hole at certain times of the year. But whereas serpents were often depicted as either symbols of good or evil, bees were almost always regarded as beneficent. The other thing is that there is a curious relationship between the bee and the serpent on a mythical level. Within the bee tradition, the marriage that occurs symbolically between the bee and the serpent creates the dragon. And the dragon is a symbol for the life force that runs through the earth, let's say the meridians of the earth. And you find this in both Eastern and Western cultures, the idea of areas where dragons live. These are areas which are pulsating often with life force. And this is where we get concepts such as the dreaming lines and the ley lines and so on and so forth.
Yes. Now, in using the bee stings, is there something else that goes along with that? I know you termed something called tanging.
Yes.
In your book, and you just spoke a little bit about the tapping and the pulsing, which is something that is used in all the shamanic traditions throughout the world. How does this fit in with the bee tradition?
Well, yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, it's particularly fascinating, I think, for Europeans, because one of the things that I think many people who work within shamanic traditions in Europe, other than in, say, Siberia or Lapland, is that they say quite accurately that there's no evidence of us having had drums over here. And it's such a universal tool these days for people practicing shamanism. But where are our drums? Where are the British drums, the Irish drums? Those people who are listening to know about the Irish baran, actually, that's a very, very young instrument. It's not an ancient instrument. So to date, there's no archaeological evidence that drums have ever been used by our British ancestors for shamanic work, even within archaeological digs where you'd expect to find them. But within the path of pollen, that's where we find the British and European drum. And it's known as a tanging quoit. And a tanging quoit is a drum made of metal. The bee shaman has used the tanging quoit for, it's always a difficult question for how long. Let's say if you go back far enough and when history slips into being myth, let's say. The idea of tanging is actually quite well known within beekeeping itself. If you were to talk to a modern-day beekeeper and you would say, what is tanging? They will say, tanging is just some superstitious nonsense where you pick up a saucepan and you bang it and the bees will land on a particular branch if they've swarmed. And it's a classic example of something that has, as it were, leaked out of the path of pollen and is actually based on a real activity based on real principle. That tanging was never done for the sake of the bees. Tanging was done for the benefit of the bee shaman. So the bee shaman would pick up this tool, this metal drum, and would begin to beat it. And they would beat it at a particular tempo, which is typically 4 to 7 beats a second. And that would then put them into an altered state of consciousness.
Be with us next week when we conclude with Simon Buxton, shaman and author of The Shamanic Way of the Bee. I'd like to thank our listeners literally around the world and to those of you who have made donations to keep our presence worldwide. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for the weekly notice of shows, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.